Welcome to Groundwire, community radio news, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations.
This week, Groundwire is produced at CKDU in Halifax. We're your hosts, Erica Butler
and Sean Purdy. This week's headlines focus on labor news from across the nation. Here's the national news.
Workers at the Fairmont Royal York Hotel in Toronto held a one-day strike on September 10th in the midst of the Toronto International Film Festival. Royal York workers have been without a contract since July 16th. They were joined by hotel workers at the Holiday Inn Bloor and the Hyatt Regency, who also held one-day walkouts during the TIFF. The September 10th day of action included support from film sector unions, who cited that good hotel jobs, like good film jobs, are vital for the economic health of the city. Internationally, hotel workers are mobilizing in 15 cities across North America, initiating a boycott of Hyatt hotels. Anne-Marie Strassel, the national spokesperson for the Unite Here Union and organizer for the Hotel Workers Rising campaign, describes the campaign's first day of action on July 22nd.
Hotel Workers Rising is a movement of hotel workers all across North America. It brings together workers who are in union hotels as well as non-union workers. And Thursday was really a historic action for hotel workers all throughout North America, who sent such a powerful message to corporations like Hyatt that they refused to be locked into a recession that they didn't create, and they certainly refused to be locked into a recession while the economy rebounds for companies like Hyatt and the billionaires who run them.
To the East Coast now. Wages are a key issue for employees at a private manufacturer of cookies, candy, and flavored syrups. Purity Factories Limited workers in St. John's are on the picket line after being locked out by the company since contract negotiations broke off on August 23rd. The employees are members of the Newfoundland and Labrador Association of Public and Private Employees. President Carol Furlong says the main issue is wages. Nearly half of the 52 employees forced out by the company have worked at Purity for more than 30 years. Local union president Carol Smith said workers were told the lockout was due to safety reasons. Calls to Purity from Groundwire were not returned, and the office was closed for business all week.
WorkSafe BC released a report in September into the deaths of three workers at a BC mushroom farm in 2008. From Burnaby, Frida Worden has the story.
On September 5th, 2008, three workers died and two were seriously injured at a mushroom farm in Langley, BC. This month, WorkSafe BC finished its report.
It took the WorkSafe BC 2 years to complete that investigation. So out of that investigation, they have now laid 29 charges. They are not criminal charges. They are stemming out of the Workers' Compensation Act.
Raj Chauhan is the NDP labor critic in the Provincial Legislative Assembly. He was also the founding president of the Canadian Farm Workers Union. He says that mushroom farming is dangerous because it is fast-paced and mostly done in the dark.
And then the recent incident that we have had in 2008, workers were sent into a pump house to check something was wrong there. There were poisonous fumes, and they, when they inhaled, they fell down, and then it was said that the employer sent two other people in there. Five workers went in, three died, and two are permanently injured, and one of them is still in coma.
The WorkSafe BC report detailing causes of this accident is still being withheld from workers' families and the public by the Attorney General's office. BC's Farm and Ranch Health Safety Association told Groundwire that since the incident, it has hired a mushroom farm safety training officer who speaks Vietnamese.
Workers at Farmers Dairy in Bedford, Nova Scotia, signed a deal with management on August 20th, ending a 6-week lockout. Talks over a new contract had broken down on July 7th. Brian Bennett, president of the Communications, Energy, and Paper Workers Union Local, said a major sticking point was raising wages to match those made by unionized workers at the Farmers Central Dairies in Newfoundland. Workers were forced to leave when management locked them out the same day talks broke down. The union had served a strike notice within minutes of the lockout. Ralph Ballum, president and CEO of Farmers Dairy, and Bennett both said the agreement was a result of give and take on both sides. In a joint statement, the union and Farmers Dairy said they are looking forward to employees returning to work with a new 3-year contract.
And now to a special labor feature on the road to unionizing for Securitas workers in Halifax. CKDU's Sean Purdy has the story.
On August 26th, the Service Employees International Union held a press conference in Halifax to demand that Securitas respect a pre-existing agreement that allows their workers to unionize. Recently, Halifax employees of the global security company have been attempting to come together in an effort, they say, to improve standards and compensation within their industry. However, the local division of the security giant has pursued active dissuasion in the form of a letter to these employees. Here is David Bush of the SEIU calling upon Securitas to use its position in the industry to set the standard and honor its commitments.
Securitas employs more than 260,000 people worldwide. Last year, Securitas announced $278 million in pre-tax profits and annual sales of around $8.2 billion. As a giant in the industry, Securitas has the responsibility to lead by example and set standards. Realizing that security officer unions can help raise security industry standards, Securitas made a commitment in its 2004 Code of Conduct and its 2006 international agreement to honor the freedom of security officers to form unions.
Part of that agreement asserts that Securitas will not only allow workers to unionize if they so choose, but to facilitate that process as well. In fact, the Sweden-based company has already facilitated such a process for their employees in British Columbia, Ontario, Quebec, Newfoundland, some of the United States, and all of Europe. An employee of Securitas for 8 years, Simon Vigneault is often called upon to be the first responder to difficult situations. Here he is describing the difficulties of this situation.
Even though I understand Securitas has made a commitment at an international level to respect and facilitate our desire to form a union, my fellow officers and I received a letter dissuading us from forming a union. But we believe a union will benefit the company because having greater job security will mean less turnover and higher standards, which will translate into more business with more positive and dignified work environments for all sides.
The employees of the Halifax division of Securitas feel that with a union in place, there will be a raise in standards, stability in their working environments, a voice to raise their concerns, and an increase in wage that currently sits between $10 and $13 an hour and is subject to individual contracts with each client. In attendance at the press conference was Elise Graham, chairperson of the Canadian Federation of Students in Nova Scotia. Citing that Securitas provides security for the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design's campuses, Graham says that unionized security guards are better equipped to protect and are likely to be more trusted by students.
Students understand and appreciate the positives that arise from workers having a voice. We believe, as a concerned student, unionized security officers will be better equipped to ensure the safety of students, our members, and the security of the spaces in which they work. We know better quality jobs will increase professionalism and lessen turnover of security officers. This will benefit students because it will mean more trust between the security officers and students and between security officers and the school.
For Groundwire, this is Sean Purdy in Halifax.
Slam a door at 3:45. I was headed for the company store. I'll watch my children starve no more tonight. I'm gonna feed them. Haven't worked in 40 days. For 23, I've had no pay. In a week, I'll have no place to stay. In an hour, they'll have to kill me. In an hour, they'll have to kill me. On the way, I met Big Johnny Hines, the strongest man in Sydney Mines. I told Big Johnny of my plight, his voice grew loud with anger. Today's as good a day to die as any that'll come to mind. I haven't home a sickly wife, I haven't worked since Easter. We haven't worked since Easter. Well, half the town will die for the mind of the call. The other half will leave when the mine decides to close. The people who left will starve to death at the hands of the company store. They'll bring the army in at us when the union gets too close to them. Burn it down, boys. Burn it down, boys. Burn it down, I said to the head. They'll shoot us down like our father's black men were already dead and down.
Welcome back to Groundwire's Feature Stories This Week. The Laurier Memorial is a landmark historical document which outlined the grievances and history of the first century of contact with non-Aboriginal people from a First Nations perspective. August 25th marked 100 years since the Laurier Memorial was signed by the nations of the B.C. Southern Interior and presented to then-Prime Minister Wilfrid Laurier. 100 Years of Struggle is a documentary by Nesky Manuel and Emma Feltz about the 1910 Laurier Memorial and its echoes through the past century. Groundwire brings you their documentary in two parts. Here's Nesky Manuel and Emma Feltz with part one of 100 Years of Struggle.
The Laurier Memorial has echoes from which our chiefs speak about or speak from. Our oral histories, our stories, the laws that were laid down by Coyote, you hear echoes of it in there, you know, and the laws that we governed ourselves by, right? And it's incredible insofar as it lays out that, you know, relations between us and Canada, to be equal partners, to share half and half and everything.
That was Dr. Ron Ignace, former chief of the Skeecheson Indian Band, discussing the memorial to Sir Wilfrid Laurier, a document that was presented by chiefs of the Sequatmuc, Inklakatmuc, and Silk Nations to then-Prime Minister Laurier as he passed through Kamloops on August 25, 1910, during a pre-election campaign tour. In the memorial, the chiefs relayed an unequivocal message, that Indigenous title had never been extinguished, that their sovereignty persisted in the territory, and that they would continue to struggle for a just and respecting relationship with the newcomers and their government until it was achieved. Here's a sample of the chief's words as laid out in the memorial.
With us, when a person enters our house, he becomes our guest, and we must treat him hospitably as long as he shows no hostile intentions. At the same time, we expect him to return to us equal treatment for what he receives. Some of our chiefs said, "These people wish to be partners with us in our country. We must therefore be the same as brothers to them and live as one family. We will share equally in everything, half and half, in land, water, and timber, etc. What is ours will be theirs, and what is theirs will be ours. We will help each other to be great and good."
The document must have resonated with Laurier, who carried it with him back to Ottawa, intending to follow up with a legal resolution. But before this could move forward, Laurier was defeated in the following federal election by Conservative opponent Robert Borden, effectively shelving the memorial and the political relationship it proposed. Now, exactly 100 years later, the vision those chiefs put forward continues to resonate in the ongoing struggles for Indigenous title, rights, jurisdiction, and reconciliation in interior BC and beyond. On July 24, 2010, at the annual Sequatmuc gathering in Kamloops, the memorial was celebrated and rededicated. In the spirit of unity, Shuswap Nation Tribal Chairman and Splachine Chief Wayne Christian presented all 17 chiefs with a rededicated memorial.
I would call upon all the Sequatmuc, Kakokpi, all the chiefs and community representatives to come up in front of the stage. What we're presenting to the Kakokpi of the Sequatmuc Nation is this piece of work here. What it is, it was done by Chris Bowes. It is the declaration, and it's framed, and we're presenting each one of the chiefs to take back to their community.
The memorial emerged against the escalating dispossession of Indigenous lands throughout BC. This dispossession was matched in escalating action on the part of the interior nations to assert their title and rights in the form of petitions, delegations to Ottawa and London, and the formation of alliances. Against this increased political action, the federal and provincial governments implemented a series of opposing policies, culminating in one final silencing effort in 1927, Section 141 of the Indian Act, which prohibited Indigenous groups from raising money or retaining legal counsel in pursuit of title and rights. Through policies like these, along with the implementation of the residential school system, the Canadian government aimed at alienating Indigenous people from their lands and laws, creating a legacy which reverberates in Indigenous communities today.
100 years later, and here we are. You know, still dealing with the same frustration that they felt 100 years ago. There's got to be a time for change, and we're standing on that threshold as leaders. We need to start maybe pushing the paper a little harder or start taking this battle to the land. We have an elder in our community that's on his deathbed. He's 91 years old. They don't think he's going to make it to Monday. I sat with him there last week and asked him, "So, how was your 90 years? And he sat and he told me story after story after story I asked him, is there anything you would have done different? He said, just one. I wouldn't have let them Semites push me off my land in the first place.
The chiefs renounced the reserve system, reminding the government of the title they had upheld since time immemorial, the jurisdictional boundaries that were already established and recognized throughout the territory, and the relationship they had with the land when the newcomers arrived.
When they first came among us, there were only Indians here. They found the people of each tribe supreme in their own territory, and having tribal boundaries known and recognized by all. The country of each tribe was just the same as a very large farm or ranch, belonging to the people of the tribe, from which they gathered their food and clothing, etc., fish which they caught in plenty for food, grass and vegetation on which their horses grazed and the game lived, and much of which furnished materials for manufactures. Thus fire, water, food, clothing, and all the necessaries of life were obtained in abundance from the lands of each tribe, and all the people had equal rights of access to everything they required. You will see the ranch of each tribe was the same as its life, and without it, the people could not have lived.
Here's former chief of the Nisqually Indian Band, Arthur Manuel.
But I was an elected chief of this reserve for 8 years. And it was the same poverty I described when I was chief 8 years ago. But it was the same poverty that my brother Bob, who was also the chief of this reserve, described 20 years ago. And it was the same poverty that my father described over 40, 50 years ago when he was chief of this reserve. This is what I mean, it's systemically created. It doesn't matter what generation, what century you're talking about. You know, we are the poorest people in one of the richest countries in the world. And we've been stuck there because the government will not recognize the fact that we own our traditional land and our traditional territories and our treaty territories. They don't recognize that.
That was part one of 100 Years of Struggle, by Nesky Manuel and Emma Feltz. Tune in to the next edition of Groundwire for part two. Last fall, Groundwire ran a story on British Columbia's cuts to a special dietary allowance for those on disability or income support payments. In Ontario, disability rights activists were alarmed to learn that Ontario will follow BC, announcing this past spring that the special diet will be eliminated. Since then, doctors who recommend the special diet have been targeted and demonstrators arrested. Here is Groundwire's follow-up report.
On August 30th, 9 disability rights activists come before the courts in Toronto on charges stemming from a demonstration against cuts to the special diet program. The demonstration took place at Liberal headquarters in May.
It was unheard of reaction where we had a protest where we briefly occupied the office, which, as I said, we were all immediately thrown in handcuffs, charged with trespass and further charged with mischief and forcible entry, and which is are fairly serious charges. So we are asking people to come out and support.
The special diet program tops up the income of those living off of Ontario Disability Support or Ontario Works programs by as much as $250 a month, and its purpose is to cover food costs. The program was especially beneficial to those with diabetes, cancer, HIV, allergies, or any other ailments. Mark Brill was among those charged with trespassing and forcible entry for his part in the demonstration against the cuts.
They've said that they will be cutting it. They haven't said when. There's a feeling amongst sort of social service agencies that there may be news very soon in the next few weeks.
Mark was also one of the patients of Dr. Wong. Applications to the special diet have to be signed by a doctor, nurse, or dietitian, and Dr. Wong was known in Toronto for supporting applications to the special diet program from amongst the city's poorest and most marginalized.
Dr. Wong had actually filled out my special diet forms and, in fact, thousands of other people's special diet forms. He just came to believe that there's a basic issue, which I think should just be self-evident, that if you don't have enough money to live on, then you are going to be at risk for a whole slew of things that are written down on the special diet form, such as diabetes.
Targeted for his outspoken support of the special diet program, many of Dr. Wong's patients now have no access to special diet funds. In BC, a similar slash to medical coverage and shelter allowances was announced in March in that province. Thousands in the province now have no access to glucose meters, contraceptives, orthotics, and more. Additionally, BC cut off an as yet unspecified number of recipients from the monthly nutritional supplement. Those who do qualify for the nutritional supplement must demonstrate they have two and not one symptoms or illnesses that require special diets. Even for those who do meet these new stringent requirements, the benefit has been reduced by $20 a month. Back in Ontario, an eerily similar storyline is emerging. Premier Dalton McGuinty's Liberal government has said that they will replace the special diet with a new program administered by OHIP, Ontario Health Insurance Plan. But they have remained tight-lipped about the details. Sarah Chartal, a lawyer who has worked with the special diet group, told local media, quote, "The elephant in the room is that in Toronto, it's not possible to rent a room for $464, the current benefit amount, let alone $364. As a result, people take money from their basic allowance to pay their rent. Because they take money from their basic allowance, they don't have enough money left over to buy food, wash their clothes, and take the TTC." End quote.
Yeah, you lose that money. You don't have enough to comfortably eat well, you know, eat fresh fruits and vegetables, and even have a life.
Those living on disability say cutting the special diet will achieve not balanced budgets, but greater health care costs. Groundwire spoke to Lisa at the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty about the real agenda of chopping the special diet.
I think the cutting of the special diet is a really clear sign of who they're going to force to pay for the economic crisis, of who they're going to force to pay for the deficit. The Raise the Rates campaign is based on a demand to raise welfare and disability rates by 40%. So that campaign began in 2005. And then in that year, we began to have discussions with health providers who wanted to start getting people access to the special diet. And we began to sort of publicize the special diet and hold clinics with health providers to sign people up to the special diet. And then this spring, in the provincial budget, the government decided to completely cut the special diet and tried to cite that it was massive fraud happening within the system and people were abusing the allowance. And I think you're going to see an explosion of people trying to access drop-ins and food programs out of drop-ins.
The Dietitians of Canada and many other medical and disability awareness allies agree. A single-parent family with one child living on income assistance in, for example, British Columbia, is now over $20 short of being able to pay the rent on the average price two-bedroom apartment. And in Toronto, the figures are even more bleak. In the last 10 years, the number of Torontonians living below the poverty line has increased from 16 to 30%. These figures, according to a report released called Losing Ground, The Persistent Growth of Family Poverty, as well as Canada Mortgage and Housing.
If you're on Ontario Works, you're basically just expected to either eat or have a place, but you can't possibly have enough money to have both.
For Groundwire, I'm Jackie Townster-Harrison with files from Annabelle Koo at CHRY in Toronto.
Activists charged in the Toronto G20 actions began the first in a series of court appearances on August 23rd. Of the nearly 900 arrested, lawyers expect many of those charges to be dismissed or withdrawn or to be referred to court diversion processes. Groundwire reflects now on the changing coverage of the July G20 events across the mediascape of Canada. This submission by Joey Grijalva of the Toronto Media Co-op.
1,000 words that the sight of a police cruiser on fire is irresistible to newspapers around the world.
On the second day of the G20 summit, you couldn't pick up a newspaper, turn on your TV, or listen to a radio report without receiving the image of a Toronto police cruiser in flames. While important economic decisions were being made inside the fenced-off fortress in downtown Toronto, and voices of opposition were shouting in the streets, it was the rioting and violence of a fringe minority that dominated the news that weekend. In interviews with activists, Toronto residents, and working journalists, we take a look at how the media fared during this tumultuous weekend. I spoke with Dylan Vickers, a Toronto college student who participated in some of the demonstrations on the first day of the summit.
Like, I was around all of Toronto yesterday, like south of Bloor Street, and what I witnessed was a lot different than what was kind of portrayed on the television media. The only images I saw were cop cars on fire, this black bloc group, destroying, vandalizing, things like that. There was like a major focus on that and that alone. I saw mostly peaceful protesters. I actually witnessed one man throw a glass bottle at the cops, mm-hmm. and a mob of about 30 peaceful protesters chased this man just because they felt so felt that he was delegitimizing their message a lot. So I felt that the peaceful protesters, people who actually just had a you know, very peaceful tactics, were being like severely unrepresented. I think it was a bit skewed in that sense.
1, 2, 3, 4, we don't want to run in war. 5, 6, 7, 8, organize and demonstrate.
5, 6, 7, 8. Pam McNair, a Toronto resident who lives near the film studio turned detention center, was an eyewitness to the Black Bloc anarchists.
I think that the media coverage has been pathetic. And I was downtown yesterday when the stuff was going on, the demonstrations were going on. Less than 100 of those Black Bloc guys walked by me on Queen Street, and that's when they were trashing like Starbucks windows and whatnot. Not one cop stopped them. And then the peaceful people, the cops were shoving aside. So I go home and I watch the news, and they're just blowing it like this thing about the city's been taken over by violent protesters. It hasn't been taken over by violent protesters. A lot of really good, peaceful people here that just want a voice, and we're allowed to have a voice. It's part of our rights as Canadians. CBC, I'm appalled. They've turned it into sensationalist journalism, and personally, I don't know if I'm ever going to watch CBC again.
At a demonstration against the repression of the G20 protests on Canada Day, I talked with Stefan Christoph, an activist and freelance journalist who was extensively investigated by the Canadian Security Intelligence Service in the lead-up to the summit.
Honestly, at some points, listening to the CBC, I thought that the CBC stood for the Cops Broadcasting Corporation, because there were no voices of dissent. There was no voices of the movements who were on the streets featured. It was cops all the time, everywhere. What we have is a media where generals and police are the order of the day, not people who the media purports to represent.
At the same demonstration on July 1st, Kai Nagata, a CBC video journalist, explained some of the reasons for the recycled images of violence seen on the major news outlets.
I think there was a lot of difficult editorial decisions to be made about which stories to prioritize and which images to prioritize. And so if you look at the coverage across most of the major networks, it was relatively uniform in terms of what we saw over and over, and that was the burning police cars at King and Bay. At the same time, there was a story to be told about what was happening inside the summit, and I feel like some networks did a better job covering the actual policies being passed than other networks. There were also a number of independent journalists, freelancers, most of them working for, I can call them left-wing grassroots publications. Mm-hmm. And what disappoints me as a journalist is to see those people being treated differently from people who have the protection of a large corporation like myself. So, no, there were no CBC journalists who were beaten or who were detained arbitrarily, but there were people who didn't have that accreditation or that protection who appear to have been the victims of one-size-fits-all approach by the police. They were lumped in basically with the crowd that they were covering.
I asked interviewees if they were finding any good alternative media outlets covering the events in Toronto.
Like, I've been looking on the CCPA Monitor website, the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and Canadian Dimension.
There was amazing work undertaken by the Toronto Media Co-op, and the Media Co-op was visited and used by thousands and thousands across the world during the mobilization against the G20. Video, photos, audio, writing.
I think people should really try and check the news on the internet, because there's just space for so much more.
Joey Grijalva, reporting for Concordia University News.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. From CKDU in Halifax, I'm Erica Butler.
And I'm Sean Purdy. Headlines this week by David Parker, Frida Worden, and Jackie Harrison.
Music by Greg McPherson. We also thank contributors Sean Purdy, Nesky Manuel, Emma Feltz, and Joey Grijalva. Thanks to the Halifax and Toronto Media Co-ops.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download editions at groundwire.ncra.ca.
Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. For their support, we thank the Public Service Alliance of Canada. See PSAC.com for more information.